omits an important aspect of the history of the last century: the accumulation of significant public assets in the industrial and financial sectors in the period 1950 to 1980, followed by major waves of privatization of the same assets after 1980. Both phenomena can be observed to varying degrees in most developed countries, especially in Europe, as well as in many emerging economies. The case of France is emblematic. To understand it, we can look back in time. Not only in France, but in countries around the world, faith in private capitalism was greatly shaken by the economic crisis of the 1930s and the cataclysms that followed. The Great Depression, triggered by the Wall Street crash of October 1929, struck the wealthy countries with a violence that has never been repeated to this day. A quarter of the working population in the United States, Germany, Britain, and France found themselves out of work. The traditional doctrine of laissez-faire, or non-intervention by the state in the economy, to which all countries adhered in the 19th century, and to a large extent until the early 1930s, was durably discredited. Many countries opted for a greater degree of interventionism. Naturally enough, governments and the general public questioned the wisdom of financial and economic elites who had enriched themselves while leading the world to disaster. People began to think about different types of mixed economy, involving varying degrees of public ownership of firms alongside traditional forms of private property, or else, at the very least, a strong dose of public regulation and supervision of the financial system and of private capitalism more generally. Furthermore, the fact that the Soviet Union joined the victorious Allies in World War II enhanced the prestige of the statist economic system the Bolsheviks had put in place. Had not that system allowed the Soviets to lead a notoriously backward country, which in 1917 had only just emerged from serfdom, on a forced march to industrialization? In 1942, Joseph Schumpeter believed that socialism would inevitably triumph over capitalism. In 1970, when Paul Samuelson published the 8th edition of his famous textbook, he was still predicting that the GDP of the Soviet Union might outstrip that of the United States sometime between 1990 and 2000. In France, this general climate of distrust toward private capitalism was deepened after 1945 by the fact that many members of the economic elite were suspected of having collaborated with the German occupiers and indecently enriched themselves during the war. It was in this highly charged post-liberation climate that major sectors of the economy were nationalized, including in particular the banking sector, the coal mines, and the automobile industry. The Renault factories were punitively seized after their owner, Louis Renault, was arrested as a collaborator in September 1944. The provisional government nationalized the firm in January 1945. In 1950, according to available estimates, the total value of French public assets exceeded 1 year's national income. Since the value of public debt had been sharply reduced by inflation, net public wealth was close to 1 year's national income, at a time when total private wealth was worth barely 2 years of national income. See PDF Figure 3.6. As usual, one should not be misled by the apparent precision of these estimates. It is difficult to measure the value of capital in this period, when asset prices had attained historic lows, and it is possible that public assets are slightly undervalued compared with private assets. But the orders of magnitude may be taken as significant. In 1950, the government of France owned 25 to 30% of the nation's wealth, and perhaps even a little more. This is a significant proportion, especially in view of the fact that public ownership left small and medium firms untouched, along with agriculture, and never claimed more than a minority share, less than 20%, of residential real estate. In the industrial and financial sectors, most directly affected by the post-war nationalizations, the state's share of national wealth exceeded 50% from 1950 to 1980. Although this historical episode was relatively brief, it is important for understanding the complex attitude of the French people toward private capitalism even today. Throughout the Trente Glorieuses, during which the country was rebuilt and economic growth was strong, stronger than at any other time in the nation's history, France had a mixed economy. In a sense, a capitalism without capitalists, or at any rate a state capitalism in which private owners no longer controlled the largest firms. To be sure, waves of nationalization also occurred in this same period in many other countries, including Britain, where the value of public assets also exceeded a year's national income in 1950, a level equal to that of France. The difference is that British public debt at the time exceeded 2 years of national income, so that net public wealth was significantly negative in the 1950s, and private wealth was that much greater. Net public wealth did not turn positive in Britain until the 1960s to 1970s, and even then it remained less than 20% of national income, which is already quite large. What is distinctive about the French trajectory is that public ownership, having thrived from 1950 to 1980, dropped to very low levels after 1980, even as private wealth, both financial and real estate, rose to levels even higher than Britain's, nearly 6 years of national income in 2010, or 20 times the value of public wealth. Following a period of state capitalism after 1950, France became the promised land of the new private ownership capitalism of the 21st century. What makes the change all the more striking is that it was never clearly acknowledged for what it was. The privatization of the economy, including both liberalization of the market for goods and services and deregulation of financial markets and capital flows, which affected countries around the world in the 1980s, had multiple and complex origins. The memory of the Great Depression and subsequent disasters had faded. The stagflation of the 1970s demonstrated the limits of the post-war Keynesian consensus. With the end of post-war reconstruction and the high growth rates of the Trente Glorieuses, it was only natural to question the wisdom of indefinitely expanding the role of the state and its increasing claims on national output. The deregulation movement began with the conservative revolutions of 1979 to 1980 in the United States and Britain, as both countries increasingly chafed at being overtaken by others, even though the catch-up was a largely inevitable process, as noted in Chapter 2. Meanwhile, the increasingly obvious failure of statist Soviet and Chinese models in the 1970s led both communist giants to begin a gradual liberalization of their economic systems in the 1980s by introducing new forms of private property in firms. Despite these converging international currents, French voters in 1981 displayed a certain desire to sail against the wind. Every country has its own history, of course, and its own political timetable. In France, a coalition of socialists and communists won a majority on a platform that promised to continue the nationalization of the industrial and banking sectors begun in 1945. This proved to be a brief intermezzo, however, since in 1986 a liberal majority initiated a very important wave of privatization in all sectors. This initiative was then continued and amplified by a new socialist majority in the period 1988 to 1993. The Renault Company became a joint stock corporation in 1990, as did the Public Telecommunications Administration, which was transformed into France Telecom and opened to private investment in 1997 to 1998. In a context of slower growth, high unemployment, and large government deficits, the progressive sale of publicly held shares after 1990 brought additional funds into public coffers, although it did not prevent a steady increase in the public debt. Net public wealth fell to very low levels. Meanwhile, private wealth slowly returned to levels not seen since the shocks of the 20th century. In this way, France totally transformed its national capital structure at two different points in time without really understanding why. Chapter 4. From Old Europe to the New World. In the previous chapter, I examined the metamorphoses of capital in Britain and France since the 18th century. The lessons to be learned from each country proved consistent and complementary. The nature of capital was totally transformed, but in the end, its total amount relative to income scarcely changed at all. To gain a better understanding of the different historical processes and mechanisms involved, the analysis must now extend to other countries. I will begin by looking at Germany, which will round out the European panorama. Then I will turn my attention to capital in North America, the United States and Canada. Capital in the New World took some quite unusual and specific forms. In the first place, because land was so abundant that it did not cost very much. Second, because of the existence of slavery. And finally, because this region of perpetual demographic growth tended to accumulate structurally smaller amounts of capital, relative to annual income and output, than Europe did. This will lead to the question of what fundamentally determines the capital-income ratio in the long run, which will be the subject of Chapter 5. I will approach that question by extending the analysis first to all the wealthy countries, and then to the entire globe, insofar as the sources allow. Germany. Rhenish capitalism and social ownership. I begin with the case of Germany. It is interesting to compare the British and French trajectories with the German, especially in regard to the issue of mixed economy, which became important, as noted, after World War II. Unfortunately, the historical data for Germany are more diverse, owing to the lateness of German unification and numerous territorial changes. So there is no satisfactory way to trace the history back beyond 1870. Still, the estimates we have for the period after 1870 reveal clear similarities with Britain and France, as well as a number of differences. The first thing to notice is that the overall evolution is similar. First, agricultural land gave way in the long run to residential and commercial real estate and industrial and financial capital. And second, the capital-income ratio has grown steadily since World War II and appears to be on its way to regaining the level it had attained prior to the shocks of 1914 to 1945. See PDF Figure 4.1. Note that the importance of farmland in late 19th century Germany made the German case resemble the French more than the British one. Agriculture had not yet disappeared east of the Rhine, and the value of industrial capital was higher than in either France or Britain. By contrast, Germany, on the eve of World War I, had only half as much in foreign assets as France. Roughly 50% of national income versus a year's worth of income for France, and only a quarter as much as Britain, whose foreign assets were worth 2 years of national income. The main reason for this is, of course, that Germany had no colonial empire, a fact that was the source of some very powerful political and military tensions. Think, for example, of the Moroccan crises of 1905 and 1911. When the Kaiser sought to challenge French supremacy in Morocco. The heightened competition among European powers for colonial assets obviously contributed to the climate that ultimately led to the declaration of war in the summer of 1914. One need not subscribe to all of Lenin's theses in Imperialism, the Highest Stage of Capitalism, 1916, to share this conclusion. Note, too, that Germany, over the past several decades, has amassed substantial foreign assets thanks to trade surpluses. By 2010, Germany's net foreign asset position was close to 50% of national income, more than half of which has been accumulated since 2000. This is almost the same level as in 1913. It is a small amount compared to the foreign asset positions of Britain and France at the end of the 19th century, but it is substantial compared to the current positions of the two former colonial powers, which are close to zero. A comparison of PDF figure 4.1 with PDF figures 3.1 to 2 shows how different the trajectories of Germany, France, and Britain have been since the 19th century. To a certain extent, they have inverted their respective positions. In view of Germany's very large current trade surpluses, it is not impossible that this divergence will increase. I will come back to this point. In regard to public debt and the split between public and private capital, the German trajectory is fairly similar to the French. With average inflation of nearly 17% between 1930 and 1950, which means that prices were multiplied by a factor of 300 between those dates, compared with barely 100 in France, Germany was the country that, more than any other, drowned its public debt in inflation in the 20th century. Despite running large deficits during both world wars, the public debt briefly exceeded 100% of GDP in 1918 to 1920 and 150% of GDP in 1943 to 1944, inflation made it possible in both instances to shrink the debt very rapidly to very low levels, barely 20% of GDP in 1930 and again in 1950. See PDF figure 4.2. Yet the recourse to inflation was so extreme and so violently destabilized German society and economy, especially during the hyperinflation of the 1920s, that the German public came away from these experiences with a strongly anti-inflationist attitude. That is why the following paradoxical situation exists today. Germany, the country that made the most dramatic use of inflation to rid itself of debt in the 20th century, refuses to countenance any rise in prices greater than 2% a year, whereas Britain, whose government has always paid its debts, even more than was reasonable, has a more flexible attitude and sees nothing wrong with allowing its central bank to buy a substantial portion of its public debt, even if it means slightly higher inflation. In regard to the accumulation of public assets, the German case is again similar to the French. The government took large positions in the banking and industrial sectors in the period 1950 to 1980, then partially sold off those positions between 1980 and 2000, but substantial holdings remain. For example, the state of Lower Saxony today owns more than 15% of the shares and 20% of the voting rights, which are guaranteed by law, despite objections from the European Union, of Volkswagen, the leading automobile manufacturer in Europe and the world. In the period 1950 to 1980, when public debt was close to zero, net public capital was close to 1 year's national income in Germany, compared with barely 2 years for private capital, which then stood at a very low level. See PDF figure 4.3. Just as in France, the government owned 25 to 30% of Germany's national capital during the decades of post-war reconstruction and the German economic miracle. Just as in France, the slowdown in economic growth after 1970 and the accumulation of public debt, which began well before reunification and has continued since, led to a complete turnaround over the course of the past few decades. Net public wealth was almost exactly zero in 2010, and private wealth, which has grown steadily since 1950, accounts for nearly all of national wealth. There is, however, a significant difference between the value of private capital in Germany compared to that in France and Britain. German private wealth has increased enormously since World War II. It was exceptionally low in 1950, barely a year and a half of national income, but today it stands at more than 4 years of national income. The reconstitution of private wealth in all three countries emerges clearly from PDF figure 4.4. Nevertheless, German private wealth in 2010 was noticeably lower than private wealth in Britain and France. Barely 4 years of national income in Germany, compared with 5 or 6 in France and Britain, and more than 6 in Italy and Spain, as we will see in Chapter 5. Given the high level of German saving, this low level of German wealth compared to other European countries is to some extent a paradox, which may be transitory and can be explained as follows. The first factor to consider is the low price of real estate in Germany compared to other European countries, which can be explained in part by the fact that the sharp price increases seen everywhere else after 1990 were checked in Germany by the effects of German reunification, which brought a large number of low-cost houses onto the market. To explain the discrepancy over the long term, however, we would need more durable factors, such as stricter rent control. In any case, most of the gap between Germany on the one hand and France and Britain on the other stems not from the difference in the value of the housing stock, but rather from the difference in the value of other domestic capital, and primarily the capital of firms. See PDF Figure 4.1. In other words, the gap arises not from the low valuation of German real estate, but rather from the low stock market valuation of German firms. If, in measuring total private wealth, we used not stock market value, but book value, obtained by subtracting a firm's debt from the cumulative value of its investments, the German paradox would disappear. German private wealth would immediately rise to French and British levels, between 5 and 6 years of national income, rather than 4. These complications may appear to be purely matters of accounting, but are in fact highly political. At this stage, suffice it to say that the lower market values of German firms appear to reflect the character of what is sometimes called Rhenish capitalism, or the stakeholder model. That is, an economic model in which firms are owned not only by shareholders, but also by certain other interested parties known as stakeholders, starting with representatives of the firm's workers, who sit on the boards of directors of German firms not merely in a consultative capacity, but as active participants in deliberations, even though they may not be shareholders, as well as representatives of regional governments, consumers' associations, environmental groups, and so on. The point here is not to idealize this model of shared social ownership, which has its limits, but simply to note that it can be at least as efficient economically as Anglo-Saxon market capitalism or the shareholder model, in which all power lies in theory with shareholders, although in practice things are always more complex. And especially to observe that the stakeholder model inevitably implies a lower market valuation, but not necessarily a lower social valuation. The debate about different varieties of capitalism erupted in the early 1990s, after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Its intensity later waned, in part, no doubt, because the German economic model seemed to be losing steam in the years after reunification. Between 1998 and 2002, Germany was often presented as the sick man of Europe. In view of Germany's relatively good health in the midst of the global financial crisis, 2007 to 2012, it is not out of the question that this debate will be revived in the years to come. Shocks to capital in the 20th century. Now that I have presented a first look at the general evolution of the capital-income ratio and the public-private split over the long run, I must return to the question of chronology, and in particular attempt to understand the reasons first for the collapse of the capital-income ratio over the course of the 20th century, and then for its spectacular recovery. Note, first of all, that this was a phenomenon that affected all European countries. All available sources indicate that the changes observed in Britain, France, and Germany, which together in 1910 and again in 2010, account for more than two-thirds of the GDP of Western Europe and more than half of the GDP of all of Europe, are representative of the entire continent. Although interesting variations between countries do exist, the overall pattern is the same. In particular, the capital-income ratio in Italy and Spain has risen quite sharply since 1970, even more sharply than in Britain and France, and the available historical data suggest that it was on the order of 6 or 7 years of national income around the turn of the 20th century. Available estimates for Belgium, the Netherlands, and Austria indicate a similar pattern. Next, we must insist on the fact that the fall in the capital income ratio between 1914 and 1945 is explained to only a limited extent by the physical destruction of capital, buildings, factories, infrastructure, etc., due to the two world wars. In Britain, France, and Germany, the value of national capital was between 6.5 and 7 years of national income in 1913, and fell to around 2.5 years in 1950, a spectacular drop of more than 4 years of national income. See PDF figures 4.4 and 4.5. To be sure, there was substantial physical destruction of capital, especially in France during World War I, during which the northeastern part of the country, on the front lines, was severely battered. And in both France and Germany during World War II, owing to massive bombing in 1944 to 1945. Although the periods of combat were shorter than in World War I, the technology was considerably more destructive. All in all, capital worth nearly a year of national income was destroyed in France, accounting for 1/5 to 1/4 of the total decline in the capital income ratio, and 1.5 years in Germany, or roughly 1/3 of the total decline. Although these losses were quite significant, they clearly explain only a fraction of the total drop, even in the two countries most directly affected by the conflicts. In Britain, physical destruction was less extensive, insignificant in World War I, and less than 10% of national income owing to German bombing in World War II. Yet, national capital fell by 4 years of national income, or more than 40 times the loss due to physical destruction, as much as in France and Germany. In fact, the budgetary and political shocks of two wars proved far more destructive to capital than combat itself. In addition to physical destruction, the main factors that explain the dizzying fall in the capital income ratio between 1913 and 1950 were, on the one hand, the collapse of foreign portfolios and the very low savings rate characteristic of the time. Together, these two factors, plus physical destruction, explain 2/3 to 3/4 of the drop, and on the other, the low asset prices that obtained in the new post-war political context of mixed ownership and regulation, which accounted for 1/4 to 1/3 of the drop. I have already mentioned the importance of losses on foreign assets, especially in Britain, where net foreign capital dropped from 2 years of national income on the eve of World War I to a slightly negative level in the 1950s. Britain's losses on its international portfolio were thus considerably greater than French or German losses through physical destruction of domestic capital, and these more than made up for the relatively low level of physical destruction on British soil. The decline of foreign capital stemmed in part from expropriations due to revolution and the process of decolonization. Think of the Russian loans to which many French savers subscribed in the Belle Époque, and that the Bolsheviks repudiated in 1917, or the nationalization of the Suez Canal by Nasser in 1956, to the dismay of the British and French shareholders who owned the canal and had been collecting dividends and royalties on it since 1869. And an even greater part, to the very low savings rate observed in various European countries between 1914 and 1945, which led British and French, and to a lesser degree German, savers to gradually sell off their foreign assets. Owing to low growth and repeated recessions, the period 1914 to 1945 was a dark one for all Europeans, but especially for the wealthy, whose income dwindled considerably in comparison with the Belle Époque. Private savings rates were therefore relatively low, especially if we deduct the amount of reparations and replacement of war-damaged property, and some people consequently chose to maintain their standard of living by gradually selling off part of their capital. When the Depression came in the 1930s, moreover, many stock and bondholders were ruined as firm after firm went bankrupt. Furthermore, the limited amount of private saving was largely absorbed by enormous public deficits, especially during the wars. National saving, the sum of private and public saving, was extremely low in Britain, France, and Germany between 1914 and 1945. Savers lent massively to their governments, in some cases selling their foreign assets, only to be ultimately expropriated by inflation, very quickly in France and Germany, and more slowly in Britain, which created the illusion that private wealth in Britain was faring better in 1950 than private wealth on the continent. In fact, national wealth was equally affected in both places. See PDF figures 4.4 and 4.5. At times, governments borrowed directly from abroad. That is how the United States went from a negative position on the eve of World War I to a positive position in the 1950s. But the effect on the national wealth of Britain or France was the same. Ultimately, the decline in the capital-income ratio between 1913 and 1950 is the history of Europe's suicide, and in particular of the euthanasia of European capitalists. This political, military, and budgetary history would be woefully incomplete, however, if we did not insist on the fact that the low level of the capital-income ratio after World War II was in some ways a positive thing, in that it reflected in part a deliberate policy choice aimed at reducing, more or less consciously and more or less efficaciously, the market value of assets and the economic power of their owners. Concretely, real estate values and stocks fell to historically low levels in the 1950s and 1960s relative to the price of goods and services. And this goes some way toward explaining the low capital-income ratio. Remember that all forms of wealth are evaluated in terms of market prices at a given point in time. This introduces an element of arbitrariness. Markets are often capricious. But it is the only method we have for calculating the national capital stock. How else could one possibly add up hectares of farmland, square meters of real estate, and blast furnaces? In the post-war period, housing prices stood at historic lows, owing primarily to rent control policies that were adopted nearly everywhere in periods of high inflation, such as the early 1920s and especially the 1940s. Rents rose less sharply than other prices. Housing became less expensive for tenants, while landlords earned less on their properties. So real estate prices fell. Similarly, the value of firms, that is, the value of the stock of listed firms and shares of partnerships, fell to relatively low levels in the 1950s and 1960s. Not only had confidence in the stock markets been strongly shaken by the Depression and the nationalizations of the post-war period, but new policies of financial regulation and taxation of dividends and profits had been established, helping to reduce the power of stockholders and the value of their shares. Detailed estimates for Britain, France, and Germany show that low real estate and stock prices after World War II account for a non-negligible but still minority share of the fall in the capital-income ratio between 1913 and 1950. Between one-quarter and one-third of the drop, depending on the country, whereas volume effects, low national savings rate, loss of foreign assets, destructions, account for two-thirds to three-quarters of the decline. Similarly, as I will show in the next chapter, the very strong rebound of real estate and stock market prices in the 1970s and 1980s, and especially the 1990s and 2000s, explains a significant part of the rebound in the capital-income ratio, though still less important than volume effects, linked this time to a structural decrease in the rate of growth. Capital in America, more stable than in Europe. Before studying in greater detail the rebound in the capital-income ratio in the second half of the 20th century and analyzing the prospects for the 21st century, I now want to move beyond the European framework to examine the historical forms and levels of capital in America. Several facts stand out clearly. First, America was the New World, where capital mattered less than in the Old World, meaning Old Europe. More precisely, the value of the stock of national capital, based on numerous contemporary estimates I have collected and compared, as for other countries, was scarcely more than 3 years of national income around the time that the United States gained its independence, in the period 1770 to 1810. Farmland was valued at between 1 and 1.5 years of national income. See PDF figure 4.6. Uncertainties notwithstanding, there is no doubt that the capital income ratio was much lower in the New World colonies than in Britain or France, where national capital was worth roughly 7 years of national income, of which farmland accounted for nearly 4. See PDF figures 3.1 and 3.2. The crucial point is that the number of hectares per person was obviously far greater in North America than in old Europe. In volume, capital per capita was therefore higher in the United States. Indeed, there was so much land that its market value was very low. Anyone could own vast quantities, and therefore it was not worth very much. In other words, the price effect more than counterbalanced the volume effect. When the volume of a given type of capital exceeds certain thresholds, its price will inevitably fall to a level so low that the product of the price and volume, which is the value of the capital, is lower than it would be if the volume were smaller. The considerable difference between the price of land in the New World and in Europe at the end of the 18th century and the beginning of the 19th is confirmed by all available sources concerning land purchases and inheritances, such as probate records and wills. Furthermore, the other types of capital, housing and other domestic capital, were also relatively less important in the colonial era and during the early years of the American Republic, in comparison to Europe. The reason for this is different, but the fact is not surprising. New arrivals, who accounted for a very large proportion of the U.S. population, did not cross the Atlantic with their capital of homes or tools or machinery, and it took time to accumulate the equivalent of several years of national income in real estate and business capital. Make no mistake, the low capital-income ratio in America reflected a fundamental difference in the structure of social inequalities compared with Europe. The fact that total wealth amounted to barely 3 years of national income in the United States, compared with more than 7 in Europe, signified in a very concrete way that the influence of landlords and accumulated wealth was less important in the New World. With a few years of work, the new arrivals were able to close the initial gap between themselves and their wealthier predecessors. Or, at any rate, it was possible to close the wealth gap more rapidly than in Europe. In 1840, Tocqueville noted quite accurately that the number of large fortunes in the United States is quite small, and capital is still scarce. And he saw this as one obvious reason for the democratic spirit that, in his view, dominated there. He added that, as his observations showed, all of this was a consequence of the low price of agricultural land. In America, land costs little, and anyone can easily become a landowner. Here we can see at work the Jeffersonian ideal of a society of small landowners, free and equal. Things would change over the course of the 19th century. The share of agriculture in output decreased steadily, and the value of farmland also declined, as in Europe. But the United States accumulated a considerable stock of real estate and industrial capital, so that national capital was close to 5 years of national income in 1910 versus 3 in 1810. The gap with old Europe remained, but it had shrunk by half in one century. See PDF figure 4.6. The United States had become capitalist, but wealth continued to have less influence than in Belle Époque Europe, at least if we consider the vast U.S. territory as a whole. If we limit our gaze to the East Coast, the gap is smaller still. In the film Titanic, the director James Cameron depicted the social structure of 1912. He chose to make wealthy Americans appear just as prosperous and arrogant as their European counterparts. For instance, the detestable Hockley, who wants to bring young Rose to Philadelphia in order to marry her. Heroically, she refuses to be treated as property and becomes Rose Dawson. The novels of Henry James that are set in Boston and New York between 1880 and 1910 also show social groups in which real estate and industrial and financial capital matter almost as much as in European novels. Times had indeed changed since the Revolutionary War, when the United States was still a land without capital. The shocks of the 20th century struck America with far less violence than Europe, so that the capital-income ratio remained far more stable. It oscillated between 4 and 5 years of national income from 1910 to 2010. See PDF Figure 4.6. Whereas in Europe, it dropped from more than 7 years to less than 3 before rebounding to 5 or 6. See PDF Figures 3.1 to 2. To be sure, U.S. fortunes were also buffeted by the crises of 1914 to 1945. Public debt rose sharply in the United States due to the cost of waging war, especially during World War II, and this affected national saving in a period of economic instability. The euphoria of the 1920s gave way to the depression of the 1930s. Cameron tells us that the odious Hockley commits suicide in October 1929. Under Franklin D. Roosevelt, moreover, the United States adopted policies designed to reduce the influence of private capital, such as rent control, just as in Europe. After World War II, real estate and stock prices stood at historic lows. When it came to progressive taxation, the United States went much farther than Europe, possibly demonstrating that the goal there was more to reduce inequality than to eradicate private property. No sweeping policy of nationalization was attempted, although major public investments were initiated in the 1930s and 1940s, especially in infrastructures. Inflation and growth eventually returned public debt to a modest level in the 1950s and 1960s, so that public wealth was distinctly positive in 1970. See PDF Figure 4.7. In the end, American private wealth decreased from nearly 5 years of national income in 1930 to less than 3.5 in 1970, a not insignificant decline. See PDF Figure 4.8. Nevertheless, the U-shaped curve of the capital-income ratio in the 20th century is smaller in amplitude in the United States than in Europe. Expressed in years of income, or output, capital in the United States seems to have achieved virtual stability from the turn of the 20th century on. So much so that a stable capital-income, or capital-output ratio, is sometimes treated as a universal law in U.S. textbooks, like Paul Samuelson's. In comparison, Europe's relation to capital, and especially private capital, was notably chaotic in the century just past. In the Belle Époque, capital was king. In the years after World War II, many people thought capitalism had been almost eradicated. Yet, at the beginning of the 21st century, Europe seems to be in the avant-garde of the new patrimonial capitalism, with private fortunes once again surpassing U.S. levels. This is fairly well explained by the lower rate of economic and especially demographic growth in Europe compared with the United States, leading automatically to increased influence of wealth accumulated in the past, as we will see in Chapter 5. In any case, the key fact is that the United States enjoyed a much more stable capital-income ratio than Europe in the 20th century, perhaps explaining why Americans seem to take a more benign view of capitalism than Europeans. The New World and Foreign Capital. Another key difference between the history of capital in America and Europe is that foreign capital never had more than a relatively limited importance in the United States. This is because the United States, the first colonized territory to have achieved independence, never became a colonial power itself. Throughout the 19th century, the United States' net foreign capital position was slightly negative. What U.S. citizens owned in the rest of the world was less than what foreigners, mainly British, owned in the United States. The difference was quite small, however, at most 10 to 20% of the U.S. national income, and generally less than 10% between 1770 and 1920. For example, on the eve of World War I, U.S. domestic capital, farmland, housing, other domestic capital, stood at 500% of national income. Of this total, the assets owned by foreign investors, minus foreign assets held by U.S. investors, represented the equivalent of 10% of national income. The national capital, or net national wealth, of the United States was thus about 490% of national income. In other words, the United States was 98% U.S.-owned and 2% foreign-owned. The net foreign asset position was close to balanced, especially when compared to the enormous foreign assets held by Europeans. Between 1 and 2 years of national income in France and Britain, and half a year in Germany. Since the GDP of the United States was barely more than half of the GDP of Western Europe in 1913, this also means that the Europeans of 1913 held only a small proportion of their foreign asset portfolios, less than 5%, in the United States. To sum up, the world of 1913 was one in which Europe owned a large part of Africa, Asia, and Latin America, while the United States owned itself. With the two world wars, the net foreign asset position of the United States reversed itself. It was negative in 1913, but turned slightly positive in the 1920s, and remained so into the 1970s and 1980s. The United States financed the belligerents, and thus ceased to be a debtor of Europe, and became a creditor. It bears emphasizing, however, that the United States' net foreign assets holdings remained relatively modest, barely 10% of national income. See PDF figure 4.6. In the 1950s, and 1960s in particular, the net foreign capital held by the United States was still fairly limited, barely 5% of national income, whereas domestic capital was close to 400%, or 80 times greater. The investments of U.S. multinational corporations in Europe and the rest of the world attained levels that seemed considerable at the time, especially to Europeans, who were accustomed to owning the world and who chafed at the idea of owing their reconstruction in part to Uncle Sam and the Marshall Plan. In fact, despite these national traumas, U.S. investments in Europe would always be fairly limited compared to the investments the former colonial powers had held around the globe a few decades earlier. Furthermore, U.S. investments in Europe and elsewhere were balanced by continued strong foreign investment in the United States, particularly by Britain. In the series Mad Men, which is set in the early 1960s, the New York advertising agency Sterling Cooper is bought out by distinguished British stockholders, which does not fail to cause a culture shock in the small world of Madison Avenue advertising. It is never easy to be owned by foreigners. The net foreign capital position of the United States turned slightly negative in the 1980s, and then increasingly negative in the 1990s and 2000s, as a result of accumulating trade deficits. Nevertheless, U.S. investments abroad continued to yield a far better return than the nation paid on its foreign-held debt. Such is the privilege due to confidence in the dollar. This made it possible to limit the degradation of the negative U.S. position, which amounted to roughly 10% of national income in the 1990s and slightly more than 20% in the early 2010s. All in all, the current situation is therefore fairly close to what obtained on the eve of World War I. The domestic capital of the United States is worth about 450% of national income. Of this total, assets held by foreign investors, minus foreign assets held by U.S. investors, represent the equivalent of 20% of national income. The net national wealth of the United States is therefore about 430% of national income. In other words, the United States is more than 95% American-owned and less than 5% foreign-owned. To sum up, the net foreign asset position of the United States has at times been slightly negative, at other times slightly positive, but these positions were always of relatively limited importance compared with the total stock of capital owned by U.S. citizens, always less than 5%, and generally less than 2%. Canada, long owned by the Crown. It is interesting to observe that things took a very different course in Canada, where a very significant share of domestic capital, as much as a quarter in the late 19th and early 20th century, was owned by foreign investors, mainly British, especially in the natural resources sector, copper, zinc, and aluminum mines, as well as hydrocarbons. In 1910, Canada's domestic capital was valued at 530% of national income. Of this total, assets owned by foreign investors, less foreign assets owned by Canadian investors, represented the equivalent of 120% of national income, somewhere between one-fifth and one-quarter of the total. Canada's net national wealth was thus equal to about 410% of national income. See PDF Figure 4.9. Two world wars changed this situation considerably, as Europeans were forced to sell many foreign assets. This took time, however. From 1950 to 1990, Canada's net foreign debt represented roughly 10% of its domestic capital. Public debt rose toward the end of the period before being consolidated after 1990. Today, Canada's situation is fairly close to that of the United States. Its domestic capital is worth roughly 410% of its national income. Of this total, assets owned by foreign investors, less foreign assets owned by Canadian investors, represent less than 10% of national income. Canada is thus more than 98% Canadian-owned and less than 2% foreign-owned. Note, however, that this view of net foreign capital masks the magnitude of cross-ownership between countries, about which I will say more in the next chapter. This comparison of the United States with Canada is interesting, because it is difficult to find purely economic reasons why these two North American trajectories should differ so profoundly. Clearly, political factors played a central role. Although the United States has always been quite open to foreign investment, it is fairly difficult to imagine that 19th century U.S. citizens would have tolerated a situation in which one quarter of the country was owned by its former colonizer. This posed less of a problem in Canada, which remained a British colony. The fact that a large part of the country was owned by Britain was therefore not so different from the fact that Londoners owned much of the land and many of the factories in Scotland or Sussex. Similarly, the fact that Canada's net foreign assets remained negative for so long is linked to the absence of any violent political rupture. Canada gradually gained independence from Britain, but its head of state remained the British monarch, and hence to the absence of expropriations of the kind that elsewhere in the world generally accompanied access to independence, especially in regard to natural resources. New World and Old World: The Importance of Slavery. I cannot conclude this examination of the metamorphoses of capital in Europe and the United States without examining the issue of slavery and the place of slaves in U.S. fortunes. Thomas Jefferson owned more than just land. He also owned more than 600 slaves, mostly inherited from his father and father-in-law, and his political attitude toward the slavery question was always extremely ambiguous. His ideal republic of small landowners enjoying equal rights did not include people of color, on whose forced labor the economy of his native Virginia largely depended. After becoming president of the United States in 1801, thanks to the votes of the southern states, he nevertheless signed a law ending the import of new slaves to U.S. soil after 1808. This did not prevent a sharp increase in the number of slaves. Natural increase was less costly than buying new slaves, which rose from around 400,000 in the 1770s to 1 million in the 1800 census. The number more than quadrupled again between 1800 and the census of 1860, which counted more than 4 million slaves. In other words, the number of slaves had increased tenfold in less than a century. The slave economy was growing rapidly when the Civil War broke out in 1861, leading ultimately to the abolition of slavery in 1865. In 1800, slaves represented nearly 20% of the population of the United States, roughly 1 million slaves out of a total population of 5 million. In the South, where nearly all of the slaves were held, the proportion reached 40%. 1 million slaves and 1.5 million whites, for a total population of 2.5 million. Not all whites owned slaves, and only a tiny minority owned as many as Jefferson. Fortunes based on slavery were among the most concentrated of all. By 1860, the proportion of slaves in the overall population of the United States had fallen to around 15%, about 4 million slaves in a total population of 30 million, owing to rapid population growth in the North and West. In the South, however, the proportion remained at 40%, 4 million slaves and 6 million whites, for a total population of 10 million. We can draw on any number of historical sources to learn about the price of slaves in the United States between 1770 and 1865. These include probate records, assembled by Alice Hansen Jones, tax and census data used by Raymond Goldsmith, and data on slave market transactions collected primarily by Robert Fogel. By comparing these various sources, which are quite consistent with one another, I compiled the estimates shown in PDF figures 4.10 and 4.11. What one finds is that the total market value of slaves represented nearly a year and a half of U.S. national income in the late 18th century and the first half of the 19th century, which is roughly equal to the total value of farmland. If we include slaves, along with other components of wealth, we find that total American wealth has remained relatively stable from the colonial era to the present, at around 4.5 years of national income. See PDF figure 4.10. To add the value of slaves to capital in this way is obviously a dubious thing to do in more ways than one. It is the mark of a civilization in which some people were treated as chattel rather than as individuals endowed with rights, including, in particular, the right to own property. But it does allow us to measure the importance of slave capital for slave owners. This emerges even more clearly when we distinguish southern from northern states and compare the capital structure in the two regions, slaves included, in the period 1770 to 1810. With the capital structure in Britain and France in the same period. PDF figure 4.11. In the American South, the total value of slaves ranged between 2.5 and 3 years of national income, so that the combined value of farmland and slaves exceeded 4 years of national income. All told, Southern slave owners in the New World controlled more wealth than the landlords of old Europe. Their farmland was not worth very much, but since they had the bright idea of owning not just the land, but also the labor force needed to work that land, their total capital was even greater. If one adds the market value of slaves to other components of wealth, the value of Southern capital exceeds 6 years of the Southern states' income, or nearly as much as the total value of capital in Britain and France. Conversely, in the North, where there were virtually no slaves, total wealth was indeed quite small, barely 3 years of the northern states' income, half as much as in the South or Europe. Clearly, the antebellum United States was far from the country without capital discussed earlier. In fact, the New World combined two diametrically opposed realities. In the North, we find a relatively egalitarian society in which capital was indeed not worth very much, because land was so abundant that anyone could become a landowner relatively cheaply, and also because recent immigrants had not had time to accumulate much capital. In the South, we find a world where inequalities of ownership took the most extreme and violent form possible, since one half of the population owned the other half. Here, slave capital largely supplanted and surpassed landed capital. This complex and contradictory relation to inequality largely persists in the United States to this day. On the one hand, this is a country of egalitarian promise, a land of opportunity for millions of immigrants of modest background. On the other, it is a land of extremely brutal inequality, especially in relation to race, whose effects are still quite visible. Southern blacks were deprived of civil rights until the 1960s and subjected to a regime of legal segregation that shared some features in common with the system of apartheid that was maintained in South Africa until the 1980s. This no doubt accounts for many aspects of the development, or rather non-development, of the U.S. welfare state. Slave capital and human capital. I have not tried to estimate the value of slave capital in other slave societies. In the British Empire, slavery was abolished in 1833 to 1838. In the French Empire, it was abolished in two stages. First abolished in 1792, restored by Napoleon in 1803, abolished definitively in 1848. In both empires, in the 18th and early 19th centuries, a portion of foreign capital was invested in plantations in the West Indies. Think of Sir Thomas in Mansfield Park. Or in slave estates on islands in the Indian Ocean. The Ile Bourbon and Ile de France, which became Réunion and Mauritius after the French Revolution. Among the assets of these plantations were slaves, whose value I have not attempted to calculate separately. Since total foreign assets did not exceed 10% of national income in these two countries at the beginning of the 19th century, the share of slaves in total wealth was obviously smaller than in the United States. Conversely, in societies where slaves represent a large share of the population, their market value can easily reach very high levels, potentially even higher than it did in the United States in 1770 to 1810. And greater than the value of all other forms of wealth. Take an extreme case in which virtually an entire population is owned by a tiny minority. Assume for the sake of argument that the income from labor, that is, the yield to slave owners on the labor of their slaves, represents 60% of national income. The income on capital, meaning the return on land and other capital in the form of rents, profits, etc., represents 40% of national income, and the return on all forms of non-human capital is 5% a year. By definition, the value of national capital, excluding slaves, is equal to 8 years of national income. This is the first fundamental law of capitalism. Beta equals alpha divided by R, introduced in Chapter 1. In a slave society, we can apply the same law to slave capital. If slaves yield the equivalent of 60% of national income, and the return on all forms of capital is 5% a year, then the market value of the total stock of slaves is equal to 12 years of national income, or half again more than national non-human capital, simply because slaves yield half again as much as non-human capital. If we add the value of slaves to the value of capital, we of course obtain 20 years of national income, since the total annual flow of income and output is capitalized at a rate of 5%. In the case of the United States in the period 1770 to 1810, the value of slave capital was on the order of 1.5 years of national income, and not 12 years, in part because the proportion of slaves in the population was 20%, and not 100%. And in part because the average productivity of slaves was slightly below the average productivity of free labor, and the rate of return on slave capital was generally closer to 7 or 8%, or even higher than it was to 5%, leading to a lower capitalization. In practice, in the antebellum United States, the market price of a slave was typically on the order of 10 to 12 years of an equivalent free worker's wages, and not 20 years, as equal productivity and a return of 5% would require. In 1860, the average price of a male slave of prime working age was roughly $2,000, whereas the average wage of a free farm laborer was on the order of $200. Note, however, that the price of a slave varied widely, depending on various characteristics and on the owner's evaluation. For example, the wealthy planter Quentin Tarantino portrays in Django Unchained is prepared to sell beautiful Broomhilda for only $700, but wants $12,000 for his best fighting slaves. In any case, it is clear that this type of calculation makes sense only in a slave society, where human capital can be sold on the market permanently and irrevocably. Some economists, including the authors of a recent series of World Bank reports on the wealth of nations, choose to calculate the total value of human capital by capitalizing the value of the income flow from labor on the basis of a more or less arbitrary annual rate of return, typically 4-5%. These reports conclude with amazement that human capital is the leading form of capital in the enchanted world of the 21st century. In reality, this conclusion is perfectly obvious and would also have been true in the 18th century, whenever more than half of national income goes to labor and one chooses to capitalize the flow of labor income at the same or nearly the same rate as the flow of income to capital. Then, by definition, the value of human capital is greater than the value of all other forms of capital. There is no need for amazement, and no need to resort to a hypothetical capitalization to reach this conclusion. It is enough to compare the flows. Attributing a monetary value to the stock of human capital makes sense only in societies where it is actually possible to own other individuals fully and entirely. Societies that at first sight have definitively ceased to exist. Chapter 5. The Capital-Income Ratio Over the Long Run. In the previous chapter, I examined the metamorphoses of capital in Europe and North America since the 18th century. Over the long run, the nature of wealth was totally transformed. Capital in the form of agricultural land was gradually replaced by industrial and financial capital and urban real estate. Yet the most striking fact was surely that in spite of these transformations, the total value of the capital stock, measured in years of national income, the ratio that measures the overall importance of capital in the economy and society, appears not to have changed very much over a very long period of time. In Britain and France, the countries for which we possess the most complete historical data, national capital today represents about 5 or 6 years of national income, which is just slightly less than the level of wealth observed in the 18th and 19th centuries and right up to the eve of World War I, about 6 or 7 years of national income. Given the strong, steady increase of the capital-income ratio since the 1950s, moreover, it is natural to ask whether this increase will continue in the decades to come and whether the capital-income ratio will regain or even surpass past levels before the end of the 21st century. The second salient fact concerns the comparison between Europe